Good afternoon. I mean, good morning. I did that yesterday too, didn't I? I'm starting to slip up. I have an afternoon show and a morning show. This is the morning show. And so I should say good morning and welcome to The Narrow Path. My name is Steve Gregg, and we are live for a half hour each weekday morning taking your calls. If you have questions about the Bible or about the Christian faith, you can give me a call at the following number. It is 1-800-227-5278. That's 1-800-227-5278. If you have questions about the Bible, or maybe you have a different outlook on something and would like to balance comment, different view than that of the hosts, always welcome here. Give me a call, 1-800-227-5278. Our first caller today is Robin calling from San Diego. Robin, welcome to The Narrow Path. Thanks for calling.
Hi, thank you, Steve, for taking my call. And I have a friend who is just coming out of Mormonism. And after 30 years of being very devout and faithful and a true believer, she's finding out that it's not true. And all the things that she believed, you know, about the Book of Mormon and Joseph Smith, it's been a real heart-wrenching experience to find out that she's been believing a lie. So now, every once in a while, she's coming out of this, religion, doubts, like, how do I know the Bible is true? You know, 14 million people believe in Mormonism and think that's true, but how do I know the Bible is really true? And so I'm just trying to...
You know, that's interesting. I'll tell you what, a Mormon brother... A Mormon guy has posted a number of times on our Bible forum at our website, and he made the point that most Mormons, if they leave Mormonism, do not become Christians but end up atheists.
Right.
And I thought that was an interesting observation. He said that Mormons, when they finally become disabused of that deception, they're not generally drawn to Christians. And he said part of the reason is because Christians persecute them. It's like I was talking to a Jewish friend last night who's also become a Christian. He said it was a very hard thing for a Jew to become a Christian. He was a Buddhist before. For many years, he was a Buddhist, but that wasn't hard. It was not hard for a Jew to become a Buddhist, but for a Jew to become a Christian was hard because the Jews consider that Christians have been their persecutors. And certainly Mormons have felt persecuted by evangelicals. Most of the conflicts they have with unbelievers in their religion are with evangelicals. So it's sometimes not attractive to them. And also, of course, once they've decided that the Word of God, as it was, they were taught, the Book of Mormon, is not true, well, the Mormons also believe that in the Bible being true. So, I mean, if they reject one book, why not reject them both? I mean, this is the way they reason, no doubt. The truth is, there's such a world of difference between the evidential basis for belief in the Bible and that for the Book of Mormon. In fact, there is no evidence that the Book of Mormon is true. There is no backup evidence. There's no archaeological finds that support the claims of the Book of Mormon. There are, for the Bible, scores of them, if not hundreds. I mean, so many of the things in the Bible have been confirmed by archaeology that at least we can say this, even if someone wishes to doubt that the Bible is inspired, or to doubt that it's the Word of God, one cannot seriously doubt that it is essentially connected to historical events, whereas the Book of Mormon doesn't give any evidence of having any historical connection. It's got a fairy tale story about, Jews or Israelites coming over to the New World and becoming the Native Americans, and then the Native Americans, you know, having these great wars and building buildings and big cities all over. Book of Mormon says, talking about North America before the colonial period, before the Europeans got here, they say that the land was covered with cities and covered with buildings. Well, archaeologists can't find any evidence that the land was ever covered with buildings or cities before the time of Columbus coming over here. So it is with everything that the Book of Mormon claims. The stories it tells are the same kinds of stories the Bible tells. That is, they should be verifiable from archaeology if they are true. The difference is that the stories the Bible tells actually do have archaeological support, and the stories the Book of Mormon tells have absolute zero support. So the Bible and the Book of Mormon are not even in the same class. We have to remember that Joseph Smith co-opted the Bible. The Bible was around and believed by most intelligent Westerners for centuries before Joseph Smith's time, and he simply co-opted the Bible into his religion in order to give himself credibility, because the Bible is in fact credible. That's what I would point out to them. Now, the Bible also gives evidence of inspiration, not only that it's archaeologically verified that many of these stories are at least true to life. I mean, many of the kings mentioned in the Bible have been discovered in archaeology, some of whom had never been mentioned elsewhere than in the Bible. That is, other historical records didn't record them. Sargon II, Belshazzar of Babylon, some of these kings that are important kings in the Bible were not mentioned by any other historians. So that for a long time, skeptics thought those kings didn't exist until they found archaeological remains and inscriptions where these kings identified themselves and told of their conquests and so forth. Mm-hmm. So the Bible at least connects with real history all the way through. But not only that, because after all, it could connect with history without being inspired. It is inspired and gives evidence because of the fulfilled prophecies. That's what God himself said is the evidence of its inspiration, is that he'd foretell the future and then it would happen. The Book of Mormon does not have that feature either. In other words, neither the historical nor the inspired character of the Book of Mormon has any verification, but both of those features of the Bible are abundantly verified. And so, to throw out the baby with the bathwater, say, well, the Book of Mormon I now realize is false, therefore, since I used to believe the Book of Mormon and the Bible, I'll throw out both. That's not really a rational way to handle the situation.
Mm-hmm. Okay, thank you.
Robin, helps. God bless you.
Thank you. You too. Bye-bye.
Thanks for your call. Bye now. By the way, if you want your friend to hear this answer, I don't know if your friend was listening today, but all of our radio shows are archived and can be listened to for free at our website, thenarrowpath.com. So shortly after this show is over, it will be uploaded, and your friend, if you want her to read it, or hear it, I should say, you can download that and play the answer for her, unless you took notes and can just go ahead and pass those things on to her. I'm assuming it's her. We're going to talk next to Robert in Covina, California, the town I grew up in from about kindergarten to my junior year of high school. Hi, Robert. Welcome.
Hello. Good morning. God bless you.
God bless you.
Yes, I had a quick question. When Jesus Christ said, let the dead bury the dead, to the young man when he said he had to go bury his father, I just wanted to get kind of your insight on that. And I was just kind of thinking about it. Does that mean that the parents of that guy were never going to come to Christ if he said, let the dead bury the dead?
Well, I don't think that was implied in what Jesus said. Jesus called this man to follow him as a disciple, and the man seemed to be putting him off by saying, well, let me first go bury my father. Now, by the way, it's very possible, many scholars feel, that his father hadn't even died yet. But to say, I need to first bury my father is a euphemism for saying, I need to live at home until my father's dead and buried, then I can come follow you. After I bury my father, I can come. And in other words, he's putting Jesus off. And Jesus said, in this man's case, let the dead bury the dead, which I think means this. When your father dies, his father might have died at this point, but we can't be sure of it from what was said. When your father is dead, he will need to be buried, but that can be done by people who are ordinary people, spiritually dead people. Most people are spiritually dead until they're born again. And therefore, he's saying, I'm calling you to be spiritually alive and to do things that spiritually dead people can't do. I'm calling you to preach the gospel. I'm giving you a commission that only living people can do, people who have spiritual life. And therefore, let those who don't have spiritual life deal with the issues that they can deal with. Let people who are spiritually dead go ahead and bury dead people. Anyone can dig a hole, but not everyone can preach the gospel. He says, so you let the dead bury the dead. That is, let those who are not called and following God take care of that matter for you, because that's easily handled by others. But you, he said, come and follow me. Come preach the gospel. So this man had a call to immediately, Jesus would immediately call him to follow him, like he called the four fishermen, or like he called Matthew from the receipt of custom. And that man was putting Jesus off with the suggestion there are some responsibilities he has to his home. And Jesus is saying those responsibilities, first of all, can be handled by anybody. It doesn't take even a Christian to bury a dead person. And furthermore, those responsibilities are not as important as what Jesus was calling him to. And therefore he's saying, don't get distracted doing what anyone can do when God is calling you to do something that others can't do. Basically what non-Christians cannot do, they can't spread the kingdom of God. This man was given a privileged calling, and he was thinking of, you know, sacrificing that for an ordinary activity that anyone could do. That's what I think Jesus is saying.
Okay, sounds really good. Thank you.
All right, Robert, thanks for your call.
All right,
God bless
you. Bye.
God bless you, too. Bye now. All right, we're going to hear again from Dana Lee from Temecula. Dana called yesterday. Dana Lee did. And welcome to The Narrow Path.
Hello, Steve.
Hi.
About that caller about Mormonism, I understand there are Mormon archaeological periodicals where they are claiming they have found things to be true, but I don't know what those publications are called or if they must be bogus then.
Well, they could very well be bogus. I mean, they're in-house publications, obviously, and they can claim whatever they want. The truth is that the, you know, an external organization not connected with Mormonism that has nothing to gain by misrepresenting the truth, the Smithsonian Institute was asked about, you know, the things that, that archaeologists have found that would support some of the claims of the Book of Mormon. And the Smithsonian issued a statement saying there's never been anything found that would support any of the claims of the Book of Mormon, although they said also there's lots of things been found that would substantiate some of the biblical stories. So even though Smithsonian is neither Christian nor Mormon, they're more of a, I would have to say, in a more objective judge about these things, they would say that the Bible and the Book of Mormon stand on opposite grounds, one with sufficient archaeological support and the other entirely lacking.
I see.
For example, I mean,
you know, I've heard sermons where God cannot look on sin, and that's why he forsook Jesus on the cross. But if he's omniscient and omnipresent, how can he not look upon sin? I mean, he sees everything.
Well, you have found a genuine flaw in the preaching you've heard.
Oh.
When people say God can't look upon sin, that's a mistake. It's based probably on a statement in Haggai, Habakkuk the prophet said, you are of purer eyes than to look upon sin. That is, God's eyes are too pure to look upon sin. What he means is to look favorably upon sin. Obviously, God sees everything. The Bible says the eyes of the Lord are in every place, beholding the good and the evil. God does look about sin, but the statement in Habakkuk literally means that God is too pure to countenance. He cannot countenance sin. He cannot look favorably upon it. It is worded.
Well, thank you.
Your eyes are too pure to look upon sin, but it means look favorably upon it.
Okay. Thanks again.
Solves the problem.
You
I think
say
your
that
preachers
Temecula
need to be more careful.
Is your new hometown?
Yeah, I live in Temecula.
You having regular meetings here?
Only monthly, because I travel and teach a great deal. But yeah, once a month, and there'll be one next month. But you'll have to go to the website to see the date, because I don't have it memorized off the top of my head.
Okay, thanks. Bye.
All right. God bless you. Bye now. All right. Our next caller is Richard from Riverside, California. I also want you to know that you can get on right now if you call. We have some lines open at 1-800-227-5278 if you have questions about the Bible or about the Christian life, or if you'd like to balance comment because you see things differently than does the host, feel free. The number, 1-800-227-5278. Richard, welcome to The Narrow Path. Thanks for calling.
Hi, Steve. Listen, I follow the Bible Bus with Dr. McGee a lot, and he mentioned that the Book of Mormon was originally written by a Presbyterian minister, and it was published and had been published at some place in the middle of the United States, and Joseph Smith happened in, and then suddenly that manuscript was missing, and then later that became the Book of Mormon, and that it wasn't Joseph Smith that wrote it at all, but he claimed authorship to it, but it had actually been written by a sort of renegade Presbyterian minister. Have you ever heard this?
Yes. Yes, that is the, as far as I know, that is an established fact.
Really?
That there was a manuscript. Yeah, there was the minister wrote it as a novel. He didn't
right.
write it as an alternative to the Bible. It was more like a religious novel that he wrote about Jesus visiting the United States and preaching to the Native Americans and so forth. And I believe the name of the novel was called Manuscript Found. I think that was the title of it. And it seems that Joseph found it and
right,
copied it, plagiarized it, and wrote the Book of Mormon. Now,
Dr. McGee, he was the first person I ever heard that said that.
Right. Now, what I wanted to say is I've just repeated what I've heard and read.
Uh-huh.
I've never seen that document, so I can't verify that the story is true. But there are book-length exposés on this that I believe are documented. So all I can say is there are people who know more about the facts than I do on that.
Uh-huh.
But that is the story I've heard, and I believe it's been documented beyond question.
Okay, well, thank you. I had heard Dr. McGee briefly mention it in one of his talks on this Through the Bible program, and it was new to me. I had never heard that.
All right. Well,
okay.
That's what I've heard and read also.
Okay, thank you.
Okay, Richard, thanks for your call. Bye now. There's a book out, which I forget the exact title, but it's something like The Real Author of the Book of Mormon or something like that. Someone listening may know the right title because it's a fairly well-known book. I don't have it, and I don't remember the title's exact name, but it's something like The Real Author of the Book of Mormon or something very similar to that, or The Real Source of the Book of Mormon. But it's, I believe, a treatment of that very information that Richard was asking about. I wish I could be more specific. I wish I knew more, but I can only share as much as I know. Okay, Joshua from Anaheim, you're next. Welcome.
Hello?
Yes. Hi, Joshua.
Hello. Oh, okay. My question is...
Are you talking through a speakerphone, Joshua?
No. Okay, hold on.
It's quite echoey.
Yeah, is that better?
Very much better, yes. Thank you.
Okay. My question is about the Illuminati and because I've been watching these videos and I just want to know what they have to do with the church, you know, with us Christians.
Well, the Illuminati is a term that is given to an alleged conspiratorial group of international bankers and other powerful people who are said to be behind the scenes controlling all governments. They're the ones who decide when wars will be fought and who will win and really who's going to come to power in countries. According to many, it's really they're the real decision makers behind international politics, and all the nations are beholden to them. In fact, it is thought that, you know, even our presidents are chosen really more by them than by the electorate. All these things are claimed, some of which may be true. I don't have, again, it's sort of like that. Sort of like what I was telling the last caller about the origins of the Book of Mormon. I read about it. I've heard about it. Some of these things seem to be very well documented, but I don't have firsthand knowledge that I could testify to it being true. So all I can say is I've heard such things. I've seen alleged documentation of it, and I have no personal reason to doubt it. In other words, I could believe it is true. I don't know that it's true, but I don't have any serious concern about it. If you wonder what's the Christian's response to this information, just assuming for the sake of argument that it is correct, assuming there really is this powerful behind-the-scenes organization really pulling all the strings in geopolitics, given that as an accepted point, I believe the Christian's response is that which we find in Isaiah chapter 8 and verse 12, through 14. Now, you might say, well, that's Old Testament. Why would that be a Christian response? Because Peter quotes from this passage and applies it to Christians in the book of 1 Peter. He doesn't quote the entire passage, but the entire passage is a single thought. And in Isaiah 8, verse 12, he says, God said to me, do not say a conspiracy concerning all that this people call a conspiracy, nor be afraid of their threats, nor be troubled. The Lord of hosts, him you shall hallow. Let him be your fear, and let him be your dread. And he will be as a sanctuary and a stone of stumbling and a rock of offense to both the houses of Israel, and etc. Now, he's talking about Ahaz, the king of Judah, is threatened by an actual conspiracy of two different kings, two powerful men conspiring together to overthrow him. This was not an imagined conspiracy. This was a real conspiracy that really existed. But God said, don't worry about that. Don't be, you know, fretting like everyone else around you saying, a conspiracy, a conspiracy. He said, don't worry about what people are calling a conspiracy. Don't be afraid of their threats or be troubled, but rather just fear the Lord and hallow the Lord, and he'll take care of you. Now, I believe that whether the Illuminati and all that I've heard about it is true or isn't true, there are obviously conspiracies. There are powerful people who get together and make plans to combine their power to get more power for themselves. And there are people like ourselves, pawns, who don't have that power and who stand to be potential victims of their exploitation or their oppression. That's, of course, the way things have always been. There's always been people in power, many of them wicked, and there's always been the vulnerable, the serfs, the peasants, the ordinary folks like me. And I just can't care. I just can't worry about what powerful men intend to do, because I'm actually a servant of a king who is not subject to them. My king is actually above them. He's the king of the kings and the Lord of the Lords. So I'll let him be my dread. I'll let him be my fear. And that's what the Bible tells me to do, and not worry too much about the conspiracies. I do think that Christians sometimes get really into this Illuminati stuff, and it becomes their whole obsession. And I think that's exactly what the Bible is telling us not to do. I mean, suppose it is true. Suppose people who are more powerful than our president are really running things, and I found out of it. Suppose I got firsthand knowledge that this is true. Excellent. Well, what do I do now? I mean, what am I supposed to do about that information? You know, I have no power over the situation. I guess I just have to trust God, right? So I'll just trust God whether I know about it or not. You know, I don't have to worry about things that aren't my responsibility to change.
Yeah, well, I really love that passage that you read, and I think you're right. You know, most Christians, they worry too much about it, and there's a lot of, like pastors and preachers who go into debt, and then, you know, at the end, what are they going to get out of it if they can't really do anything?
And people get really excited. People get really excited about esoteric knowledge. Like, if I know something most people don't know, and then it becomes their obsession, and then they cease to be obsessed with Jesus like they should be. It's just one of the devil's distractions. I'm not saying that the Illuminati doesn't exist. I'm not even saying that there's no danger of an international conspiracy. I there may well be.
Yeah.
In fact, I suspect there is. You know, I tend to believe it. I just don't know. But it doesn't matter to me.
Yeah.
I'm part of a more important kingdom than that, and it's not subject to them. Joshua, I'm almost out of time, and I need to take another caller, but I hope that answers your question for you.
Oh, it sure did, and thank you so much.
Well, thank you very much for calling. It's good to hear from you. Let's talk to Andrew from Hacienda Heights next and last today. Hello, Andrew. Welcome.
Hello. Thank you for taking my call. God bless you and your ministry. My question is, when Jesus brought back Lazarus from the dead, he was dead 4 days, correct? And what I wanted to find out, where was Lazarus in those 4 days? Did he go to Abraham's bosom? And if he did, which I think he did because the plan of salvation hadn't been completed, was he able to, you know, be out there with, like, Moses and Elijah and all them that went to Abraham's bosom?
Well, we don't know the answer to that because we're not told, but it is possible. It is. It's kind of fun to imagine that, and it may be a correct way of looking at things. We only have on that information, on that subject, we only have information from one passage, and that is, of course, Luke chapter 16,
right,
and verse 19, where there's another man named Lazarus, not the same
right.
one, but another one who dies, and he is said to be in Abraham's bosom, and We're not told that he's in the presence of Moses and David and the prophets, but I think we're intended to understand that where he's gone is where they've gone to. We don't have any depiction of those men being down there as with him, but I think it's perhaps we're supposed to just understand that that's the case. So there would be reason. There would be reason to say that Lazarus did go down in, among those people, and then he came back. There was a kind of a cool song that a Christian musician named Carmen did, where he kind of dramatized Lazarus going down there and hanging with those Old Testament guys and talking with them, and they're kind of swapping testimonies. And suddenly he's telling his testimony, and then suddenly he begins to hear the call, and he's drawn away and has to leave him behind. It's kind of a fun song, but I mean, it's imaginary, but it could reflect some measure of truth of what Lazarus experienced after he died.
So all we could do is just speculate then, right? Because
I was thinking,
you know, when the Mount of Transfiguration, when Moses was there and Elijah was there and Jesus was there, so they sort of recognized them. So that's why I somewhat was thinking along that line. Matt, it must have been, you know, pretty amazing to be down there, then come back to life, and would he have been able, hey, you know, I saw Moses, and I saw, you know, me telling his.
I know, wouldn't that be something? It's interesting that there's no record of anything that Lazarus said at any point in the Bible. No quotes from Lazarus either before or after his death are given. And people say, well, why didn't he talk about, you know, heaven and hell if he saw those things? Oh, we don't know that he didn't. We don't know what he did or didn't say. There's actually no words of Lazarus recorded in the Bible, yet we have no reason to believe he was mute and never spoke, and therefore, whatever he spoke, probably he did speak about his experience. We just don't have any record of it. We're out of time, though. I appreciate your call. You've been listening to The Narrow Path. Please go to our website, thenarrowpath.com. There's lots of free resources for you there. We're also a listener-supported ministry, and from our website, you can find out how to help us stay on the air. That's thenarrowpath.com. God bless you.